The Bob Murphy Show, episode 40.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, Bob Murphy here. We've got another solo episode for, well, I'm not sure if it's solo because it's basically going to be me responding to Tucker Carlson. So in a sense, Tucker Carlson is my guest and we're just going to not really have much of a conversation. It's more of alternating monologues. And Tucker didn't agree to be on the show. But other than that, it's basically like I'm going to have him on the show. Before I jump into this, let me just mention, mark the date. On Saturday, August 17th, 2019, I am going to be, along with Carlos Lara and David Stearns, presenting in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to have another IBC seminar for the general public. We don't have the venue totally nailed down right now, but again, it's going to be Saturday, August 17th, 2019. I'll be in Atlanta, along with the rest of the Nelson Nash Institute board, putting on a seminar about IBC, the infinite banking concept, intended for the general public. So stay tuned. I'll give you more details as they come in. So what I'm going to be talking about today, I'm sure many of you have heard it, is Tucker Carlson recently had a segment where he praised Elizabeth Warren's plan for U.S. workers, saying it sounded like Trump at his best. And he went on. The reason this was such a big deal in libertarian slash Austrian circles is in his monologue, Carlson ended up claiming that the modern GOP leadership is beholden to libertarian ideology and they're taking cues from the Austrian economists rather than from, you know, common sense and what actually would be good for them in terms of political fortunes. So it's the Republicans are not only defying common sense, but also hurting themselves politically out of their ideological rigid devotion to doctrinaire libertarianism and Austrian economics. So you can imagine actual Austrian and libertarian thinkers thought that was pretty funny. Would that it were so, Tucker. But and I also perhaps am a little bit late in getting this out, but you know, I thought if you haven't seen Tucker Carlson's show, you might enjoy hearing this, and maybe I'll make some points that others haven't. And by the way, I intentionally did not listen or read other people's commentary on this because I wanted to be fresh and not be influenced by what somebody else said. So here's my take on it. Let's get going.
Let's begin with a thought experiment. What if the Republican leadership here in Washington had bothered to learn the lessons of the 2016 election? What if they'd cared enough to do that? What if they had understood and embraced the economic nationalism that was at the heart of Donald Trump's presidential campaign?
Okay, so that's setting up the premise. I just wanted to play a little bit of the intro just so you understood where he was coming from and you weren't completely lost. And now I'm going to skip ahead just in the interest of time. He reads a quote that ends up being from Elizabeth Warren. And his point is that this is something that Republicans, if they were smart, they would have in their own agenda. And yet they don't do that. And then he offers reasons as to why no Republican would actually have the courage to say the things that Elizabeth Warren is saying. Okay, so here again, he's going to be quoting. At this point, you, the Fox viewer, don't know it's Elizabeth Warren, but I'm telling you that just so you don't get confused. So we're going to go through now, and this is Tucker Carlson quoting Elizabeth Warren, and I'm going to respond to her arguments.
Quote, "I'm deeply grateful for the opportunities America has given me, but the giant American corporations who control our economy don't seem to feel the same way. They certainly don't act like it. Sure, these companies wave the flag, but they have no loyalty or allegiance to America. Levi's is an iconic American brand, but the company operates only 2% of its factories here. Dixon Ticonderoga, maker of the famous number 2 pencil, has moved almost all of its pencil production to Mexico and China. And General Electric recently shut down an industrial engine factory in Wisconsin and shipped the jobs to Canada. The list goes on and on. These, quote, American companies show only one real loyalty to the short-term interests of their shareholders, a third of whom are foreign investors. If they can close up an American factory and ship jobs overseas to save a nickel, that's exactly what they will do, abandoning loyal American workers and hollowing out American cities along the way.
Okay, so that's the basic premise, and I'll spend the most time on this particular clip and responding to it, because this is really where the economics comes in. So you'll notice there's one group in there whom Elizabeth Warren completely ignored, and Tucker Carlson as well. And in fact, you never hear this word, I don't believe, in the entire 8.5 minute clip here that I'm listening to, that this whole segment is. And I'll, of course, post the link at bobmurphyshow.com/40 if you want to listen to it without me chopping it up, just to make sure everything's in context. But I'm pretty sure the following word literally never occurs. Certainly it wasn't in that little clip I just played for you there. And that word is consumer. And so the whole framing of this that Elizabeth Warren gives you and then the Tucker Carlson echoes is that you've got these companies, and originally they're located in the United States, and they have certain production costs, and they're selling their products, and they realize they're running the numbers, say, oh my gosh, if we outsourced our operations and we moved our factory from the United States, where we have to pay high wages because Americans get paid a lot, if we moved the operations elsewhere, although it's not like Canada is the third world country, but in general, the way these arguments go, oh, we moved the manufacturing out of the United States to take advantage of lower labor costs, or as they say, to save a nickel. And then, of course, the idea is, and so that means they do that. And the implicit story here is that they sell the products for the same amount of money, or same price to the final consumer, and the savings they earn in order or by doing that, because they shipped their operations to a country that has lower labor costs, they just pocket for their shareholders. And so, okay, first of all, even if that were true, if that were the whole story, okay, you know, there's nothing that entitles you as an American to have other people deploying their property in order to give you products. That's not your right. People have the right to do what they want with their own property. And so if somebody can make more money shipping their operations overseas, under what rule do you get to stop them from doing that? And beyond that, though, of course, that's not really, well, hang on a second. So they, how they're trying to guard against one possible issue is you might say, okay, to the extent that these are American shareholders who are benefiting, it's not obvious that's hurting Americans, right? That American shareholders making more profit or net income because their company produces the product at the lowest possible cost, that's good for American shareholders. So it's not clear how that's hurting America by doing that. And so Warren and Tucker try to shield against that by saying, oh, and some of these shareholders aren't even Americans. Okay. But again, the big picture here, what they're missing, the huge elephant in the room, is that by having lower production costs, that allows them to have lower prices for the consumer goods. And so what's missing in this entire clip, this whole analysis, is that to the extent that companies are able to lower production costs by moving their operations to take advantage of cheap foreign labor, that means Americans are able to get cheap goods made abroad. And that definitely helps Americans in that respect. And so what you have here are, for any particular decision, you can look at it in terms of winners and losers, and that's fine. But so here's the idea, that a particular company moves its operations out of the country, and by lowering labor costs, let's say, let's just assume that's what the issue is. There's all kinds of things going on, but let's just keep it simple because that's the paradigmatic example here that all these people have in mind. By doing that, then, oh, you're hurting the U.S. workers who used to have that job, and now they got to go take some other job instead. Okay, that's right, and I'm fine saying that particular decision, other things equal, hurts those U.S. workers. But who does it help? It helps any shareholders who, some of whom are Americans, so those are Americans that it helps. And beyond that, more broadly, it helps American consumers. And so it's odd. Why would you just focus on the workers who are being harmed and not look at the benefits accruing to those other two groups? And think of it like this, just to, again, make it really simple here, but just try to isolate it just to get the logic down. Imagine you're a U.S. consumer, and you have $100 and you normally pay an American chiropractor, let's say, $100 for a session that he goes through and, you know, adjusts your back and whatever. Okay, great. Now you realize, oh, wait, suppose you live right next to a border. You live right next to the Mexican-U.S. border. And then you realize, oh, wait a minute, there's a guy who's right across the border. It's the same distance from my house. Your house is right on the border. You go 10 minutes inland one way into the country, or you go 10 minutes the other way and cross the border. Or you cross the border, and this Mexican chiropractor will do the same service for you. Like, he's just as skilled, or, you know, you have just as much relief from your back aches and whatever after seeing this doctor versus the other one. But he only charges $90 equivalent. And so, hey, you're just thinking your own narrow interest. Oh, I'll just go do that. And so there's a sense in which, you know, you're out $10. And by the way, the U.S. doctor that you have, how much is he out? You might say, oh, he's out $100, and that's why Americans lose on net. But no, that can't be right. Because what that doctor clearly can do with his time is more valuable than $90 worth. Right? He can sell that hour of labor or whatever was going to be for more than $90. Because if that weren't the case, he would just lower his prices. Okay, so in the new equilibrium, if you're getting some of your services now from the Mexican doctor, because your American doctor counterpart, the chiropractor, is still charging $100, well, then that shows that he's able to do that, the American doctor. He's able to earn $100 per hour. Okay, and this is something that it's really lacking from the typical man on the street critique of outsourcing, or just in general, hey, it's not fair for American workers to have to compete with all these foreign workers, because how can they with such low wages, that, you know, that kind of argument. Why is it that American wages are so much higher than foreign wages when you're comparing them to certain countries? That's not a fact of nature. Why is that? Well, it's because the American workers, I mean, there's lots of specifics, but in general, the answer is their labor is more productive per hour. They produce more stuff per hour, and that's why they tend to get paid more in real terms per hour. With their paychecks, they can go to the store and buy more stuff with it than their Mexican counterparts, or their counterparts in India or Bangladesh or in China. Right? And so why is that? It's because their labor is more productive. So again, back to my hypothetical example there, when you're looking at, you know, my decision as an American consumer who wants to get a session for someone to adjust my back, and I could pay $100 to the American chiropractor, or I can cross the border and pay $90 to his Mexican counterpart. And there's an obvious sense in which I, as an American consumer, would gain $10 if I took my business across the border. And so I'm pointing out, what's the loss, if you will, to the American doctor from my decision? Don't think of it as him losing $100. That's not correct. Because if it were correct, then he would be willing to cut his prices, right? If the U.S. doctor, the U.S. chiropractor, realized that he was going to earn $0 for the relevant time and period in question because I want to cross the border to go buy it for $90 from the Mexican counterpart, then the U.S. doctor would be willing to do it for $89. But he's not. He said, no, I'm not going to work for that. I have better uses of my time. In fact, I have people paying me $100. That's why his price is $100. Okay, so on the margin, he's not losing that. And that's why, just in this very simplistic example, this is the way like a Chicago school economist or somebody, or UCLA economist, would analyze it. The next best use of that doctor's time from getting my $100, you know, if I were to hire him and he would use his hour to give me chiropractic services for $100, the next best use of that U.S. chiropractor's time is to do something that's worth more, that he can charge more than $90 to do. Because if it weren't, again, this is a pretty simple argument, if it weren't the case that he could use his time to earn more than $90, then why wouldn't he match the price of the Mexican guy that I'm taking my business to? So that's the fundamental point there. And so that's the insight by which you can see by me, again, assuming that the numbers and the situation is as I've stipulated here, by me looking at it, and if it really is true that they're the same type of service as far as I'm concerned, somebody who needs adjustment on my back, and I could either pay $100 to the U.S. worker, or I could cross the border and pay $90 to the Mexican one. And to me, they're the same. There's an obvious sense in which I, as an American, would gain $10 by using the import, if that's the way you want to think about it. And how much does the American worker in this case lose? It's less than $10. It's certainly not $100. So make sure, you know, rewind the tape if you have to get that down, but make sure you see that logic, because that's the whole essence of it. And so you can see that if I, either because the government forces me to or because Tucker Carlson just makes me feel bad and guilty, if I were instead to say, oh, wow, I got to support America, I'm going to pay $10 more for, quote, the same service, even though I could get it for $90 and from a Mexican worker. Instead, I'm going to pay $100 to have a U.S. doctor give me that service. Then I'm down $10. That's just made America poorer by $10 to be offset by the gain to the doctor. But we've already seen the gain is less than $10. The next best use of that doctor's time was to sell services to somebody and charge more than $90. Because again, if he didn't do that, then he could just match the Mexican worker's price. So in general, you know, switch to a different example now. If that you know, it's a car factory, right? So some some GE plant. That's the example they used in the clip here that Elizabeth Warren. Well, I don't know if Elizabeth Warren picked it or yeah, I think it was her. In any event, it's either her or Tucker Carlson saying GE. They had some factory somewhere. They're making stuff, paying U.S. workers. They run the numbers and decide to move it elsewhere. And so to the extent, I think they said they moved it to Canada. So there it's not obvious exactly what the issue was, but they move it to some other, you know, third world country or second world country, primarily because of lower labor costs, let's say. Then the first thing to ask yourself, if you consider that to be an outrage, is, well, how come the U.S. workers don't just match the wages of, you know, those foreign workers? Why don't they just say, oh, hey, we'll be willing to work for what they were willing to work for? And so number one, if you say, oh, well, they can't because there's minimum wage legislation. All right, well, then the problem there is minimum wage legislation. Okay, but in most cases, that's really not what the issue is. It's that the U.S. workers would not be willing to work for such low wages because they have better alternatives. There's better uses of their time than to match the low wages of those foreign workers. And so again, that's showing that the gain to the company in the narrow sense, just from the immediate switchover, is bigger than the loss to the U.S. workers who now have to work at the second best alternative. And so that right there shows, you know, why it's, quote, efficient in a sort of bloodless Chicago school sense. But if you're worried about, you know, I don't care about these fat cat shareholders, I care about the people, right? And so to the extent that there's competition, the company cannot forever just pocket that difference. If they're able to produce their product at much lower costs, then ultimately that's going to be reflected in lower prices for the products. And so it's ultimately consumers, many of whom are American, they're going to benefit from that. And so this really isn't an issue about companies hurting Americans. It's an issue of hurting U.S. consumers to benefit U.S. workers. And it's not just a wash. As I've shown you, the harm to the consumers is greater in the aggregate than the benefits to the workers. So this is just another way of looking at the standard case for free trade and why protectionism doesn't work. That yes, any particular tariff put in place by the U.S. government and that keeps out foreign imports or restricts them will benefit the U.S. workers involved in that particular sector. But obviously the flip side is it hurts the U.S. consumers who previously were buying those imported goods. And moreover, it's not a wash. The gains to the workers are smaller than the losses to the consumers. Now, the reason politically tariffs are popular, first of all, is because of economic misunderstanding that the public who might even be hurt by them doesn't fully get the ramifications. But beyond that, there are more consumers than there are producers for a particular good, generally speaking. And so even though the aggregate losses to U.S. consumers are bigger in dollar terms, they're spread out over more people. So no individual car buyer is out that much if the Trump administration imposes a modest tariff on automobiles, whereas U.S. workers in auto factories benefit a lot, relatively speaking. And so that's why, you know, the unions might donate to politicians who put tariffs in place, whereas there's not nearly as much rationale for consumers to come together as a political bloc and have lobbyists going and lobbying for free trade. Just it's, you know, it's not really worth paying lobbyists to do that because the benefits are so dispersed. All right. But that's the basic logic of it. And again, you just have to ask yourself, why is it that U.S. workers get paid more than workers abroad? And the answer is because they're more productive. And so that's how the division of labor works. That think of it this way, how can foreigners possibly compete with U.S. workers who are more productive than them? Well, they charge less for their labor. Just like within the country, there not every worker has the same productivity, right? The brain surgeon is more productive than the janitor at the hospital. Oh my gosh, so that means all the janitors are perpetually unemployed, right? And they starve. No, they earn less. They charge a lower wage than the brain surgeon does. And that's how people all find a role in the division of labor. And that same principle applies at a global scale. And so, you know, it'd be pretty arbitrary to say, oh no, the only firms that are allowed to hire foreign workers have to be firms that started out in that country. Just that would be kind of a coincidence if that's the way the numbers worked, that it just so happened the most efficient location for every firm was in the country in which it was founded. Why would you expect that to be the case? Just like some firm that was founded in Minnesota, would you, if you checked in on it 30 years later, would you expect that all of the components that it buys, you know, everything that are inputs into its production process, all come from the same original vendors that the founder picked 30 years earlier? Or is it possible that the situation changed and they just said, oh, instead of getting our electricity from this person, we'll switch to this company? Or instead of getting our wood pulp from this vendor, we'll switch to this supplier, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. So that's the basic logic. All right, let's get back to Tucker Carlson here.
Politicians love to say they care about American jobs, but for decades, those same politicians have cited free market principles and refused to intervene in markets on behalf of American workers. And of course, they ignore those same supposed principles and intervene regularly to protect the interests of multinational corporations and international capital.
Okay, so that's the one legitimate point that I think Warren makes and that Tucker Carlson repeats, is that the politicians who on some particular issues might say, hey, you know, free trade, laissez-faire, we don't want to mess with markets, will then also bail out companies as they did after 2008 and elsewhere. So that's certainly a fair point, and they're hypocrites on that. But more generally, this idea that, oh yeah, the political class, they're so committed to laissez-faire, and that's why U.S. workers can't get a break, is because federal politicians refuse to help them. No, it's the other way around. It's federal politicians who are shackling U.S. workers. And this is also true to the extent that, well, I'll keep playing the clip because they're going to make the point for me.
The truth is that Washington policies, not unstoppable market forces, are a key driver of the problems American workers face. From our trade agreements to our tax code, we have encouraged companies to invest abroad, ship jobs overseas, and keep wages low, all in the interest of serving multinational companies and international capital with no particular loyalty to the United States.
Okay, so that's half right. So again, what I liked about that was Warren, quoted by Tucker Carlson, saying, the truth is, I'm paraphrasing here, I remember the exact quote, the truth is that it's not market forces, but actually Washington policies that are driving this result. So what they mean by that is, you dogmatic libertarian types don't hide behind the wonders of the invisible hand. And hey, that's just what, you know, efficiency, baby. And who are we to judge the profit motive? Or who are we to second guess cost benefit analysis? You know, what those bean counter economists tell us, that's the right outcome, baby. That's efficiency. Resources go into their most high valued use. And Warren and Tucker Carlson are saying, no, this is not just the result of some even playing field, and that's the way the cookie crumbles. This is because of specific Washington policies, and that's why these policies need to change, gosh darn it. And actually, yeah, I agree with that, that when we do see particular companies leaving the United States to set up a factory elsewhere, even though everything I just said up till now in the podcast I endorse, you know, that's why I said it, I think it's correct, but it does matter if the reason a company can get lower production costs elsewhere isn't merely that foreign workers have lower wages, and therefore it makes sense for particular firms to go take advantage of that that low wage opportunity. Let me, before I dive into this particular point, well, let me, I'll make this point and then I'll circle back because I'm concerned I didn't hammer that home enough. But let me just finish this train of thought right here. And so to the extent, though, that the lower production costs that are available abroad aren't merely due to the differences in productivity of the workers and the fact that some, you know, have lower wage demands, but it could also be because there's fewer regulations. And so to the extent that it's hard for a company to operate in the United States because of the tax code or because of goofy regulations on businesses and things that aren't as prevalent elsewhere, well, then what I said is still true. Yes, given those regulations and those taxes, the company does better for itself and for its customers by going somewhere with lower production costs. But the solution isn't just to say, oh, yep, and that's the beauty of the market. No, you could go ahead and if you wanted to be a politician and do something about that, you would get rid of the stupid regulations. All right, so for example, if the federal government sent around people who went into factories that were located in the United States, you know, like Levi jeans factories and went around and burned half of the jeans anytime they saw them, that's not helping anybody. That's certainly not helping Americans and it's not helping American consumers. And so if Levi's then moved its operations abroad where those American arsonists from the federal government couldn't get at their inventories and burn half the jeans anytime they saw a stockpile, that would be good for the company and the shareholders. That's true. But it would also be good for American jean buyers. Again, assuming the regulators only attack the jeans when they're in the factory, that once they get into your drawer at your house, they don't burn them. Okay, so that everything I said is still true, and it would be wrong for Tucker Carlson to wag his finger at Levi's and say, you're hurting Americans by moving abroad. You should keep your business here. No, that's hurting Americans if they were to do that. But it's also true that it would be even better still if the government stopped sending arsonists around to light fires on jeans that they find within the borders of the United States at a company, you know, on company property. All right, so that's a silly example, but what the federal government does in the real world is equivalent to that. There really is a sense in which the U.S. federal government destroys a large percentage of productive activity or the output of productive activity gets squandered complying with federal regulations and the effects of the tax code and so forth. So that's all true. And yes, part of the way the government could ameliorate that situation is they could change their policies. So it is true. I agree with Elizabeth Warren and Tucker Carlson that U.S. government policy, and also, you know, state and local, of course, is one of the reasons that U.S. companies find it more profitable to outsource. But where Warren and Tucker Carlson are going with this is to say, oh, and so that's why we're going to impose tariffs, or that's why we're going to do other kinds of penalties, threatening businesses. If you do leave, then bad things will happen to you. Okay, so now to continue with that fire analogy, that would be like, oh, we notice companies are moving abroad because people from the government set fire to Levi's jeans that are located inside the factory. Okay, well, you know what? To stop that, we don't like this new trend we're noticing. So now if we catch you selling jeans to Americans from a factory that you just moved across the border, it's true, we don't have the authority, we don't have the jurisdiction to cross the border into this new country, enter your factory there and burn half the jeans as they're sitting inside your warehouse. We can't do that now because you fiendishly moved outside of our jurisdiction. But when the jeans come in, because Americans still buy your jeans and now they're cheaper, we'll intercept them in the mail process and we'll rip them in half there. And that's the way, you know, we'll disincentivize you from shipping your operations abroad. And we're doing all this, of course, to make America great again. We're doing this to make Americans richer. All right. There, that would clearly be stupid. And I'm saying economically, what they're doing is equivalent to that, that there's taxes and regulations in place that cripple American businesses, raise their production costs. And so part of what they're doing when they scramble to try to make a profit and then competition forces them to pass those profits along to their customers is they may locate some of their factories abroad. And then if the government, in order to punish them for that or to try to get them to not do that in the first place, puts in place tariffs so that, oh, if Americans would not want to buy those products, we're going to make them artificially more expensive to try to undo that savings the company just came up with the way they evaded some of our costly regulations and taxes here at home. We'll just make sure you get a hit on a different, you know, the product coming, whether it's coming or going, the tax man's going to come in and make it artificially expensive. Say what you will about that, but that's not helping Americans. That's not making America richer. To the extent that the cause of outsourcing is U.S. government policy, then yeah, go ahead and fix it. But the problem's not a depressing reluctance on the part of American officials to tax commerce, which is the way Warren and Tucker Carlson are framing this, if their solution is tariffs. Okay, circling back though, let me mention this. Why is it, so given that Levi and GE and the company that makes the number two pencils, I forget what they said the name of that was, some of them outsource, you know, and it happens every month or so, you might see, oh, some new factory gets outsourced. Okay. Why didn't every single company outsource at the same time? Like, why is there any job left in the United States whatsoever? And you could say, well, you know, most service industry, they can't. Okay, but why are there any manufacturing jobs? It's not like manufacturing jobs went from 50 million to zero in 1 year. So why is it? If it made sense for GE to move one of its factories overseas or out of the country, why doesn't it move all of its factories likewise? All right. And so you see, it's because there's particulars in each situation and labor costs are just one element. And also has to do with the productivity involved. So certain operations can be outsourced, other ones can't be. And again, at any given time, anybody in a market. So here, yes, you kind of have to flip back and forth. But if somebody's blaming laissez-faire for something, the way to combat that accusation is to first imagine a laissez-faire world and show, no, what you're saying doesn't make any sense. So I know we don't have a pure free market right now, but if we did, outsourcing could still happen in that environment. But my point is, it wouldn't be every single firm outsourcing so that every single American now is unemployed. Because if that were the case, then the wage rate that Americans earn would keep dropping until all of a sudden it made sense for firms to come back in. And so if we're in an equilibrium where every American who wants to work, you know, and has a modicum of productivity, there could be, you know, somebody with, mental handicaps or whatever who just really isn't worth the effort for a certain firm to hire him and train him and stuff because he just can't retain the skills. But in general, there's a sense in which anybody who's able-bodied and willing to work in a market economy can get a job. If the productivity is not that high, the wage rate will be low, but anybody who wants to work can get a job. And so if we're saying, oh, a particular company outsourced because the workers in foreign lands were willing to do that job for a lower wage than anybody in America would be willing to do, well, you have to ask yourself, why is that? What's propping up their wages in America? And it's because they found better things to do. So that's the way in a market economy, in a global scale, that people find their role in the division of labor, their little niche. So it's not that every job gets outsourced. People still working at Google can still, you know, in Silicon Valley, they still stay there. Musicians and whatever in LA and Nashville and New York still find it advantageous to work there. But perhaps, yeah, certain factory jobs do get outsourced. And that's, again, it can't be that every single job on earth is done in America. And, you know, if you took this economic nationalism to its logical extreme, it's like, okay, well, I mean, ideally, I guess Tucker Carlson would want every firm in the world to try to come in and hire Americans and produce everything in the U.S. and the U.S. just exports everyone else. But then, you know, I guess nationalist politicians in those other countries would say, no, that's crazy. Why are we outsourcing to America and hurting Bangladeshi workers? Let's produce locally, make Bangladesh great again, or great for the first time, whatever. And so ultimately where this logic leads is every country should just produce everything internally and there should be no trade. And I'm not going to go off on a tangent here now, but that would be crazy. Everybody on earth would be much, much poorer if that's the policies we adopted. And so it's shocking that Tucker Carlson just so breezily says that without apparently worrying about the consequences. Okay, let's get back to it.
It's becoming easier and easier to shift capital and jobs from one country to another. That's why our government has to care more about defending and creating American jobs than ever before, not less.
So here, Tucker Carlson doesn't elaborate on this, but the standard. So Paul Craig Roberts back in, 2003 to 2007, in that range. Paul Craig Roberts, many of you probably know him. He was sort of wagging his finger and chastising conventional libertarian free market economist types by saying, you guys are missing the boat here. The American manufacturing base is getting hollowed out. And the conventional Ricardian case for free trade no longer applies. Because Paul Craig Roberts was saying the standard case that, you know, the classical economists had in mind was that you could ship goods easily from one country to the other, but that the workers and the capital were fixed. And in that, you know, under those assumptions, yes, the Ricardian case for comparative advantage and blah, 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 and free trade, that goes through. And a country that's better, you know, its workers can make more of every type of good, more units per hour. Still, it benefits if it specializes in the sectors where it has the comparative advantage, makes more of those things and exports them and trades with countries where they can specialize in the things where they have the comparative advantage. Even though, again, their workers are worse at making those things than your workers are, still, your workers should specialize where they really have an advantage. And, you know, you can run the numbers and everybody, at least in per capita aggregate terms, is richer if you specialize in trade. And so what Paul Craig Roberts was saying is that's no longer the situation. That now when companies can outsource and capital can effectively move across borders, this situation is no longer applicable. And so he's right that the standard demonstration by which you could, you know, have a simple model where, oh, there's two countries and the workers in country A can produce these two goods with these productivities and the workers in country B can produce those two goods with these productivities, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, he's right that particular demonstration for the virtue of free trade doesn't work because it's, you know, making assumptions that no longer hold. But that doesn't mean, so therefore, the case for free trade collapses. It just means you have to change what the argument is or slightly change your model if that's the way you want to think about it. And so I had a series of articles where I responded to Paul Craig Roberts, you know, both his direct arguments, and I also used thought experiments just to try to show that, you know, this stuff doesn't really matter. To give you a quick example of the thought experiment I did is Paul Craig Roberts was saying something like, So he was conceding the original case for free trade where, you know, you import a cheaper product, then the gains to the American consumers outweigh the losses to the domestic American producers, and therefore that is more efficient. It makes America richer. So you wouldn't want to restrict the ability of American consumers to buy imports from foreigners who can make the thing more cheaply than their domestic counterparts. So Paul Craig Roberts was stipulating that. He was saying, but where things break down is situations like now because of technology, that if you are an American patient, you know, you need medical services, you can just go to a clinic in the US and they can hook you up and scan you. And then some doctor in India can, you know, look at your MRI results or your CAT scan or whatever, and then diagnose your condition and then email it or whatever, do a Skype call or something across the ocean and give you your diagnosis. And so that Indian doctor is undercutting US doctors. And this kind of thing is not at all what, you know, the original case for free trade was based on. You know, this is because this case, now you can see how it's different. It's the service, the capital, as it were, is now more mobile. And, you know, he's saying, so this is not the typical case. So the way I responded to that was saying, well, okay, but just think of it as the Indian doctor puts his diagnosis, he writes it on a piece of paper and he puts it into a box and ships it across the ocean. And so now that's more clearly the case for free trade that the classical economists were considering, where you're importing something more cheaply. Or suppose they, you know, they made some device that sort of codified all of the, you know, the wisdom of the Indian doctor. You know, you made a handheld device that you input all of the MRI readings into, and then it spit out a diagnosis, and that's what you bought. You know, so American Hospital bought that device, shipped it in from India, and had that sitting in the wing, and it laid off all of the U.S. doctors. By the way, forget the fact that a lot of the doctors in the, you know, living in the United States working at U.S. facilities are from India, but, you know, assume that that's the case. Okay, so you still go to your U.S. hospital, There's no communication with India going on. It's just they take your readings, they walk down the hall, and they take this box out that they imported from India, and they type the readings in, and then it spits out the diagnosis. Clearly, that falls under the original parameters of the case for free trade that Paul Craig Roberts stipulated. And so now you're telling me there's an important economic difference. What if you say, well, how does this box work? That's amazing. What if you open it up and realize, oh, wait a minute, there's Wi-Fi here. They were just, you know, communicating with the human Indian doctor across the... We thought all his knowledge had been codified into this box like a magic eight ball. Turns out, in real time, this thing was sending the MRI's readings overseas and the doctors over there were typing in the answers. So now all of a sudden, this hurts Americans. You're telling me that whether, you know, that that's really the issue? That if all the information in their minds had been codified into the box, that makes America richer? But if it turns out, no, it's just because of Wi-Fi that makes America poorer? That's goofy. All right. So that's the kind of thing I did. I'll link to my articles there. But the point being, even though it's true that as capital and labor now become more mobile, the original Ricardian type demonstration, and by the way, David Ricardo was not the first person to come up with what we now call comparative advantage. But in any event, that sort of classical economist argument, it's true that that's not fully capturing what's happening in the modern world. But at the same time, that doesn't mean, therefore, the policy conclusion's wrong. And it's still useful to walk through that sort of reasoning to see how is it that protectionism would still hurt Americans if we're talking about the U.S. government. Okay, back to Tucker Carlson.
We can navigate the changes ahead if we embrace economic patriotism and make American workers our highest priority, rather than continuing to cater to the interests of companies and people with no allegiance to America. End quote. Now, let's say you regularly vote Republican. Ask yourself, what part of the statement you just heard did you disagree with? Was there a single word that seemed wrong to you?
Lots of words.
Probably not. Here's the depressing part. Nobody you voted for said that or would ever say it. Republicans in Congress can't promise to protect American industries. They wouldn't dare to do that. It might violate some principle of Austrian economics.
All right, so stop there. So that was the line that made everybody crack up. So on the one hand, I'm flattered, and it does show that Tucker Carlson, despite himself, is actually very informed here, that he knows enough to talk about Austrian economics. I'm not going to say anything profound here, except it is not the case that the modern GOP has been swept up by Austrian economics. It's kind of like Paul Krugman, when he was responding to my article, The Importance of Capital Theory, said something like, somebody sent me this article by Robert Murphy making the Austrian case for, it was the best exposition of the Austrian case that's sweeping the GOP now when it comes to stimulus spending, or something like that. And it was very cute and touching. So yeah, the idea that the GOP senators and Congress people are representatives are just reading Human Action at the beach and so forth. But in any event, back to Tucker Carlson.
It might make the Koch brothers mad. It might alienate the libertarian ideologues who to this day fund most Republican campaigns. So no, a Republican did not say that, sadly. Instead, the words you just heard are from, embrace yourself here, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. It's true. Yesterday, Warren released what she called her plan for economic patriotism. Amazingly, that's pretty much what it is, economic patriotism. There's not a word about identity politics in the document.
Okay, I'm stopping it right there. Listen to what he just said. He said this is Warren's plan was a document for economic patriotism, and there wasn't a word about identity politics in there. You mean except the part about the economic patriotism, right? Let me, again, just replay that. So listen to the irony, folks. He's going to say what it is and then say there's not a word about identity politics.
Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. It's true. Yesterday, Warren released what she called her plan for economic patriotism. Amazingly, that's pretty much what it is, economic patriotism. There's not a word about identity politics in the document.
So I think most of you understood immediately what I was getting at there, that economic patriotism, what does that mean? It's saying we are standing up, we are recognizing those, and what's special about them? People who are American. That's the thing that we're going to focus on. That's what's going to drive our politics, is your identity as an American. So yes, that is identity politics. That's exactly identity politics. Now, it's true. It's not what we tend to think of by that phrase, the people who engage in identity politics and talk about black people or gay people or immigrants, you know, that sort of thing, then that's normally what people mean. Oh, identity politics. But here they're talking about American workers. And notice also, it's actually really not even Americans, as I pointed out earlier. It's focusing on American workers and assuming America is nothing but American workers. And so that if you hurt American consumers to the tune of $1 billion in order to help American workers to the tune of, let's say, $800 million, so that you've made America $200 million poorer, you still say, ah, we're helping America there because the consumers don't even count, even though they're Americans, right? So that's what's ludicrous about that. So, and this is what drove, of course, the title of my podcast episode, where I said that Elizabeth Warren and Tucker Carlson want affirmative action for American workers, because that's really what it is. I mean, what do we normally mean by affirmative action? Like from these identity politic groups that Tucker Carlson doesn't like, somebody will say, oh, well, because of past injustices, black workers can't get a fair shake. You know, they face discrimination, the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, the persisting problems of racial prejudice. And so they can't get a fair shake. And that's why companies need to go out of their way to, you know, whenever there's a job applicant or a job opening, they should really go out of their way to make sure that black applicants, you know, are given first consideration, that sort of thing. And, you know, depending on the person, somebody objects, hey, that's unfair. You know, that's reverse discrimination. No. We're not, you know, saying that you should help them and put it to the detriment of others. We're just saying give them a bigger consideration, you know, give them a second look, that sort of thing, depending on, again, the argument. Or other people might explicitly say, yes, that's right. That's how we have to compensate for past discrimination, is we're now going to reverse discriminate against the historically privileged groups, right? They have different responses depending on who you're talking to. So how is that any different from what Warren and now Tucker Carlson are saying U.S. companies should take when it comes to their hiring decisions? They're saying, hey, you've got 1,000 openings in your factory, and you've got applicants, and they're equally qualified, and this one group over here is willing to do the job for $15 an hour, and this group over here is willing to do the job for $8 an hour, and we're saying you should go with the more expensive one. Why? Because they're American. You should give preference when you're hiring to American workers because they're American. So that's what I'm saying. This is affirmative action for U.S. workers. You could say it's good, but don't deny that that's what it is. That's exactly what it is. I'm not like trying to be funny or be cute or make some kind of analogy. No, when you carefully define, rigorously define, without plugging in specifics, what does affirmative action mean? It's saying you give preference to certain workers or, you know, admission into college or whatever, depending on what this issue is. But if we're talking about when it comes to hiring decisions, affirmative action means you don't do it based purely on merit and what's good for the company's profitability. You do what's not in the company's best interest because you're giving extra consideration to one group of applicants because of their racial or other sort of attribute of their background, what class they belong to. And Elizabeth Warren and Tucker Carlson are saying when U.S. companies make hiring decisions, they should give a huge preference to workers who happen to be American and not to workers who are not American. So that's affirmative action for U.S. workers. Just, you know, if you just say, okay, fine, that's what it is, great, but don't deny that that's what it is, all right? And then beyond that, for all the reasons that conservatives who watch Fox News, generally speaking, are aghast at affirmative action, well, then they should do that here as well. So I'm not going to repeat all the reasons, but they all would apply here. All right. Well, I think I've made my point. There's other things that he says. They go on to say, last one I'll make here, I won't quote it. I won't play the quote, is they say, among other things, that the U.S. government, when possible, should buy from U.S. firms or should buy American. And, you know, that's just kind of funny. What do you mean when possible? It's always possible. Right, it's, you know, unless you're talking about maybe like rare earths or something, even there you could do it. It's not that China has a literal monopoly on that stuff. So when they say phrases like that, what that means is oh, if the U.S. government has bids out for, you know, takes bids for a contract and there's a U.S. firm that's in the running, you know, that's not just totally way above some foreign firm, then go with them. But, you know, that's a pretty arbitrary consideration. Like, well, okay, what if a U.S. firm puts in a bid at $1 billion and some foreign firm can do the same thing for $500 million? Well, you know, should the taxpayers have to pay double for that? All right, so that's the flip side here again. If the U.S. government hires American firms when foreign firms could do the job more cheaply, then that means taxpayers are paying more than they need to. So again, it's not clear. How does that make America richer to have taxpayers overpay for something? Now, again, here, obviously, I'm an anarcho-capitalist, so it's not that I want the U.S. government to be efficient. But I'm not talking about that. I'm saying in the logic of Elizabeth Warren and Tucker Carlson, who think there are worthwhile programs that the federal government spends money on, and the issue is how should they select the firm that delivers it, then, yeah, other things equal, they should go with the cheapest one. Now, the other things could include security and reliability and stuff like that. So you think some foreign companies stealing secrets, then maybe you don't want to go with them. But it's not because you're buying American. It's because you're excluding people who are screwing you over, right? So it's not an animus for foreign companies per se, or an unwillingness to hire foreign workers. It's because, oh, we think that this particular Chinese firm stealing our technology from our microchips or whatever the allegations are. Okay, so that's fine. You can take those things into consideration. You don't just have to look at what the number is on the bid and go with the lowest one. You can do all sorts of other considerations. But the point being, if you are going with a U.S. firm merely because it's American and you think you're helping U.S. workers, well, the only way you're able to pay them more is by taxing American taxpayers more. So you're just transferring money from the broad citizenry into the pockets of a few select workers. And so just rearranging money among Americans doesn't make America richer. In fact, because it's going through Washington, in general, it makes America poorer. All right, I'll stop there, folks. I think you get the point that it's, I guess the last thing I'll say too is, it's not a coincidence that Elizabeth Warren is embracing this. Tucker Carlson goes on to act like, not surprising it's coming from her, because normally she has all these positions I hate, but on this one, she gets it right. And I understand that Tucker Carlson is trying not to just be like everybody else. He's not trying to be tribal and, hey, I call it like I see it, and I get that. And also, I'll give the caveat that he's good on certain war issues. You know, and he says things that you're shocked he's getting away with, and someone has the courage to say that on Fox News. So, yes, I get all those caveats. But nonetheless, when it's coming to economic nationalism and patriotism, what he's been saying, it's not just that I disagree with it. He's just betraying a fundamental ignorance of economics. And then on top of that, when he insults Austrian economics as if we're the ones, you know, who've been running the show, it's pretty laughable. Actually, let me dig up one last clip here just to show you how out of touch this monologue is from Tucker Carlson, and we'll end on that.
So who is this Elizabeth Warren, you ask? Well, not the race-hustling, gun-grabbing abortion extremist you thought you knew. Well, unfortunately, Elizabeth Warren is still all of those things, too. And that's exactly the problem, not just with Elizabeth Warren, but with American politics. In Washington, almost nobody speaks for the majority of voters. You're either a libertarian zealot controlled by the banks, yammering on about entrepreneurship and how we need to cut entitlements. That's one side of the aisle. Or worse, you're some decadent trust fund socialist who wants to ban passenger cars and give Medicaid to illegal aliens. That's the other side. What there isn't is a caucus that represents where most Americans actually are. Nationalist on economics, fairly traditional on the social issues. Imagine a politician who wanted to make your health care cheaper, but wasn't ghoulishly excited about partial birth abortion. Imagine someone who genuinely respected the nuclear family and sympathized with the culture of rural America, but at the same time was willing to take your side against rapacious credit card companies bleeding you dry at 35% interest. Would you vote for someone like that? My gosh, of course you would. Who wouldn't? That candidate would be elected in a landslide every single time. And yet that candidate is the opposite of pretty much everyone currently serving in our Congress. Our leadership class remains resolutely libertarian, committed to the rhetoric of markets when it serves them, utterly libertine on questions of culture, Republicans will lecture you about how payday loan scams are a critical part of our market economy. Then they'll work to make it easier for your kids to smoke weed because, hey, freedom.
Okay, and that was the part that just made me laugh out loud. Okay, so I played a decent clip chunk of it because I wanted you guys to see where he was going, what his stream of consciousness was there. And so you get where he's coming from. But then you're like, oh, okay, I see what he's putting. And then that last part, the Republican leadership is so resolutely libertarian on economic matters, but libertine on social issues. I mean, does that sound to you guys like the Republicans, you know, that they're running around trying to legalize weed because yay freedom, and that they're also in favor of rapacious payday lender loan scams? So they might, certain ones might kill a bill that would, you know, impose limits on that stuff, but they certainly wouldn't defend it the way he just said they would. So, I mean, even there, he doesn't have it right. But certainly it's not that the Republican leadership is pushing to legalize marijuana. I mean, if it were, why is marijuana still legal in so many places? I mean, that's what's so weird about that is Tucker Carlson's making it sound like originally in the state of nature, marijuana was illegal. And then throughout the years, it's these Republicans who keep going to Washington trying to legalize marijuana. And the people keep saying, no, stop, please don't. And, you know, everyone from Richard Nixon down to Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush have been doing their best to try to push bongs on high school kids. And it's only, you know, the rank and file GOP members who are resisting these tendencies or these motivations from the top. So I just, out of curiosity, I pulled it up. Right now, I'm looking at the senate.gov/senators/leadership.htm for those who want to look this up, because I was just curious to see. So it says constitutionally mandated officers. So Vice President Mike Pence is up there. And then the party leadership, the Republican leader is Mitch McConnell. And they're listing other ones whose names don't really mean much to me. You got Chuck Grassley is also up there. So are these names that strike you as people who say they want to legalize weed for make it easier for your kids to smoke weed because yay freedom? That's the thing too. It's not just that Tucker Carlson saying guys like Mike Pence and Mitch McConnell are pro-legalization when no, they're not. But even if they were, even to the extent that in the state legislators of they are legalizing things, it's not because Republican politicians are coming out and saying, you know what? God made those herbs and you can smoke what you want. How can a plant hurt you? That's not what they're saying. They're doing medicinal marijuana. They're doing stuff like this. Like, well, it helps with these things. And, you know, or gosh, it's just costing so much to lock up these people. And maybe we should try treatment instead of punishment. And who knows? That's the kind of stuff they're doing. Or, hey, you're bringing a lot of revenue, and maybe we could use that to do such and such. And yeah. They're certainly not saying, yay, freedom. Like, who are we to tell you what you can do with your body? That's certainly not what Republican leadership is saying. So, again, I appreciate Tucker Carlson. He's not trying to just parrot the two sides. He's trying to be an independent voice and say something provocative. And he knows if he does say something provocative that gets everybody angry, they're going to share the clip, and that's a good thing from his point of view. Okay, I get all that, but I was sort of tracking what he said. Oh, there's not a politician who does these things. But again, when he wraps up with, and that's why you've got all these libertarian ideologues in the GOP who vote laissez-faire when it comes to economic matters and who are libertine when it comes to social issues. No, that's actually not at all the case. And ironically, in terms of influential Republicans in Washington right now, probably the one who is the most pro-legalization of weed would be Trump. I'm not saying he's pro-legalization of weed, but I'm saying in terms of his remarks and some of the things he's been signing off on, it would be Trump, right? I'm looking at a political article here from April 4th, 2019. Senator Cory Gardner said Thursday that President Trump told him he'd sign legislation to ensure states can decide for themselves whether to legalize marijuana, but that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell needs some more convincing, and da-da-da, and it goes on with that stuff. Okay, so in general, when it comes to Trump administration, I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump is the one who's, I mean, he's a New York City real estate developer who has multiple affairs and things, and, you know, has affairs with porn stars and stuff. He's not the conservative Bible thumper, right? That would be Pence if you're going to pick somebody like that. All right, so this is, anyway, I'll wrap it up there, folks. This has been the Bob Murphy Show, and We've got some more interviews in the can. Looking forward to putting them out. Thanks for listening.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.